This is the book that boxing has always needed. It's a shattering yet moving, informative yet tender, an essential read for anyone who cares about boxing and its courageous damaged fighters. Thus spoke Donald McCrae in The Guardian about Damage, the untold story of brain trauma in boxing, the old story of fame driving fast cars, making piles of cash, and then coming the fall, booze, drugs, depression, poverty, and illness. The dark narrative was called Punch Drunk Syndrome. The book is called Damage, the Untold Story of Brain Trauma. It is by Tris Dixon. Delighted to be joining me live on the line from the UK. Tris himself. Tris, good morning to you.
Good morning. How are things?
Very well, thank you. It's an interesting story, isn't it? It's a story almost as old as boxing itself, the rise and fall of boxers through what was often seen as their own excesses.
Yes, of course. And, you know, but it's something that hasn't really been discussed and certainly not under the microscope in any great detail by the sport itself. And obviously there's been a recent trend in recent years for other sports to go under the microscope. Obviously, it really kick-started with the NFL and their concussion crisis and looking to see what happened to the damaged players in retirement. And it was actually while just doing some casual pop culture reading about that, that I thought, hang on, you know, there's a lot of similarities between this and boxing and what's happening to the NFL guys. The same thing was happening, had been happening to fighters for 100 years. And it was only then that I realized that CTE, chronic traumatic encephalopathy, is actually the modern terminology for punch drunk syndrome. So it's actually boxing's problem in the first place.
And if you think about it, I mean, NFL concussion is if you like, it's a byproduct of a contact sport. Boxing is different. I mean, the aim of boxing is to render your opponent unable to fight.
Well, yes, I mean, I have a slightly different outlook, and having boxed, it was never really about that for me. It was more about hitting a target. So the same way a shooter would go to the shooting range and you see an opening, you try and hit the target. It's not necessarily, you know, there was never really any malice intended. Maybe that's why I was never any good at it. I agree in what you're saying, in the sense that obviously that is the way that you win a fight, certainly in an impressive fashion too.
So what was the spark then? Was it reading this report that made you delve deeper? Or, you know, you said you were a boxer yourself. Have you seen the effects on this in your contemporaries, in your peers, or the group perhaps, you know, who were boxing a decade or two decades before you?
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, I've been in boxing 25 years, and I'd be lying if I didn't have my own concerns about what might happen to me down the line. But I've been wanting to write a book about life after boxing for a while, and people had come at it from a slightly different angle. I've written about depression in boxing for a while without understanding the links to head trauma and depression as well. So there was a piece of the puzzle that fitted there too. And I wanted to write about why these fighters struggle. I wrote Ricky Hatton's autobiography with him, War and Peace, and there was obviously plenty of food for thought, thinking, why does a guy who has everything struggle with his mental health? And then obviously you start to look back and you see Joe Calzaghe and you see Frank Bruno and you see countless others in British boxing and further afield. So it was really a combination of wanting to write about what happens to fighters after the final bell and obviously learning about what had happened with the NFL and their concussion crisis.
I mean, do you think that previous to that, I'm thinking of cases like Sonny Liston and lots of other boxers like that. It was so easy to just say, oh, well, you know, they come from impoverished backgrounds. You know, they're not that clever. You know, they get into the ring and then when the bright lights and the final bell rings, they've got nothing to do with their lives. So that's where they go. You know, that's where they slip into obscurity.
Well, I think this is one of the areas that I found most fascinating, and it's certainly something that neuroscientists across the pond and over in the UK are trying to find out, because obviously a lot of fighters do come from trauma and they come from extreme poverty. And so it's hard to understand how much of that has an effect on them later in lives and what part of it might be down to trauma from the blows they've received in the ring. So there's studies going on at present, a huge fighter study in Las Vegas with more than 800 participants from MMA and boxing, where they're trying to sort of monitor and track fighters' brain health over time. And obviously they're trying to piece the puzzles, put the pieces together of fighters' backgrounds as well, and trying to see if people might have been sort of doomed from the start, shall we say, in terms of their upbringing, or whether brain trauma has you know, massively changed their personalities and outlook.
And I mean, if you think about it, and I know this isn't directly to do with trauma, the brain trauma, but no other sport puts you, if you like, you know, out there in front of millions of people, you know, on show to face your demon, the other guy. And if you don't win the fight, if you are defeated, you know, the impact that can have on your psychology must be massive.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, there's huge amounts of pressure. And I think that's part of the reason why the fighters find it so hard when they do retire, is because, you know, everything's on the line, and the adrenaline that gives a fighter, you know, we've seen fighters try and replicate that through drugs and gambling and all other sort of methods they can to replace that high and the buzz of having such high stakes. And it is irreplaceable. There's nothing like it. And it's a danger, because these guys aren't equipped to deal with what comes after when they have those highs to replace, and they can't replace them.
So who did you first approach then? You'd mentioned that you'd helped Ricky Hatton with his book. So you had obviously you had contacts within the industry to who to call on. So who were your first ports to call, and what was the reaction like from? Because I know you spoke to journeymen as well as perhaps the household name. So, you know, what was the reaction like when you said you were doing a book on this?
So it was interesting. There were people who've had to deal with it, people who've had it in their family, and whether it's been wives or widows or children who've looked after elderly relatives and so forth. And to a man, and in fact, a couple of the neuroscientists in America said, you know, this is a great thing that you're doing, because people don't talk about it. And really, that's one of the motivations for the book. It's to make it comfortable to talk about the uncomfortable, because no one in boxing wants to talk about it because of the stigma attached to being a punch drunk fighter. And, you know, punch drunk is a dirty phrase. It was first used medically back in 1928. And it really has picked up a derogatory connotation ever since. And it's something that I'm keen for the sport to lose and obviously replace it with CTE. But the first port of call, you know, it was one of those things where when I would speak to fighters, there's basically not a lot of knowledge about it in the sport. So for a lot of people, I was sort of educating them. And that's another one of the reasons why I wanted to write it. It's because, you know, I've been in boxing 25 years, and I couldn't have told you what CTE is. I couldn't tell you what tau protein is, which is the toxic form of protein that's formed in your brain when you've taken several thousand blows to the head, that starts to basically kill the brain cells and shut the brain down. I couldn't have told you any of that. And I'd been the editor of Boxing News, and I'd fought, and I'd been in countless gyms, and no one had ever told me any of that stuff. So, you know, with hindsight, obviously being a parent, someone who's now playing soccer, playing football, it makes me, I see things in a different light. And I'm not part of a woke establishment where I think, oh, you know, everything needs to be outlawed and all the rest of it. I'm not like that at all. In fact, I'm a very old school guy, but I'm just aware of what's going on now. And I had my eyes firmly closed to it. And like I said, I was old school. I was thinking, you know, a championship fight's only got to be 15 rounds. You know, oh, you've got to give your all in the ring. And we've seen these fighters recently thrown under the bus for what people say quitting is, like Daniel Dubois and Billy Joe Saunders. And, you know, you just realize there's so much more to life than boxing, because these guys might retire at 35, and all being well, they've got 50 years of their life to live afterwards, you know, and you want them to be in the best health possible afterwards. And if that means calling it a night early one night, then so be it. At least they can continue on with their families for the rest of their lives.
I mean, do you think there's a pressure now with, you know, the huge amounts of money coming up, the TV, the pay-per-view? I mean, should there, you mentioned cutting back maybe the number of rounds and also the number of times a fighter is fighting throughout the year. I mean, they're still sparring, they're still training. It's not just that one night in the ring, is it?
Yeah, no, I mean, I wouldn't cut the rounds down from where they are unless there was scientific proof now. I mean, they did cut them from 15 to 12. And in terms, I think the volume, I think you've touched upon it there. I think the volume of what people do in the gym is probably excessive. You know, for a championship fight, sometimes you hear someone sparred 150 rounds and they've really gone hell for leather. But obviously, if you have 10 fights, you know, if you're prepared for 10 of your fights there, then you're racking up the rounds, and say you hit to the head maybe 6 to 10 times in a round if you're half decent, then obviously you only need to multiply that by the several hundreds. and it's quite a concerning figure. So I think sparring is one of the ways that people can change and help their lives down the line. But I think the problem comes, and this is part of the book as well, is there's such a haphazard structure to boxing that there's no way of implementing this. You know, you can't go in the gyms and supervise everyone. All you could do is put out guidelines so that people could understand the implications of what too much sparring is, you know, when too much is too much or when enough is too much. And also, I think you say there about the volume of fights. It's a hard one as well, because not all fighters are coming out damaged. So you look at someone like George Foreman, who I spoke to for the book. He had a couple of long careers as a heavyweight with a gap in between. And we had a great conversation about his career in boxing. And he's in his 70s now and still going strong. So you think, well, you know, I could list, you know, several fighters who are doing marvelously well in later years. So it's not everyone. And this is another thing that scientists are trying to work out is, you know, is anyone predisposed to it? If you have Alzheimer's, dementia, Parkinson's, or ALS in the family, do you have a predisposition to it? There's lots of different things in play that people are trying to work out what causes it.
And you talk about, you know, you mentioned the magic word woke there, but it's an interesting one, isn't it? Because, you know, you are bringing this to the fore at the same time as professional footballers are looking at the heading of the ball that was done in the 60s and the 50s, those leather balls. When you see the 66 World Cup squad, a lot of them are succumbing to dementia. And rugby union are now looking at that as well with the early onset dementia that's happening with several players. So it's not a question of you going, oh, isn't this awful? I mean, people are starting to think, do these sports that involve contact in the head area, you know, is there long-term damage, and what can we do about it?
Yeah, definitely. And you know, the thing that I think separates what I've done from the other stuff is I've actually actively had a go at the stigma of boxing. And like I said, the punch drunk terminology for these guys that you mentioned in soccer and rugby, and I say soccer because I've got an American publisher, so I'm used to saying it now, it's one of those things where there's not really a stigma attached to it. You know, if you have dementia from football or CTE from football or from any other sport, it's not really seen as a negative thing. But in boxing, you know, so many fighters are seen to be sort of, you know, pitied upon because they've wound up in a bad way. And it's a narrative that I really want to change, because these guys gave their all in the ring. They did put everything on the line, and they deserve to be treated with respect for the courage they've showed over the years and the courage that they show now. Now they're damaged fighters down the line and fighting every day. So that's really one of the things I wanted to tackle. And it's about that stigma and the fact that punch drunk is used in modern terminology. I mean, Donald Trump, not the best example, I know, but he used it to describe Robert De Niro a few years ago. And, you know, it's that bad. You know, that's how it's used. It's an insult. And we really need to get rid of that stigma so that we can be more open talking about it and working on it and treating not just the physical signs, but the emotional signs and everything else that goes with it.
And what can the industry itself do? Because, I mean, you know, big name promoters, you know, it's a fast moving world. Is there any sort of support system put in at the moment for those who are suffering from this? Or is the industry taking a serious look at this? Are promoters interested in this, or are they just more interested in bringing on the next big thing?
I think they're probably too busy looking for the next big thing, unfortunately. I think really what boxing needs is a global federation, a real international oversight, for example, so that fighters fall under one medical umbrella worldwide. At the moment, someone might fail a brain scan in this country and go and get a license to fight in Luxembourg. And someone might fail a brain scan in California and go and get a license to fight in Texas. It's the wild west of sports. And really, you know, all the medical information should be shared on one medical database so that these guys aren't putting themselves in harm's way. And so that when they have reached the end of the line, enough is enough. And, you know, Muhammad Ali was a great example. No one would license him in America. So he went and fought in the Bahamas for his final fight. And it was a terrible fight where he took a real beating. And those are the loopholes that boxing really needs to stamp out to move forward safely and to start looking out for the fighters rather than people cashing in on the names of what people used to be like.
Who impressed you, or who had the biggest impact on you when you were doing these interviews? You know, which boxer or which promoter or which person in the industry made you think, yeah, this person has an idea, has a handle on it, or this person should be getting treated an awfully lot better than they are at the moment?
Oh, that's a great question. There were a couple of interviews that really stand out, and one was, I was very good friends with one of the all-time greats called Aaron Pryor, and his widow, Frankie, spoke to me for the book. And I suppose, really, and she was phenomenal. She'd obviously lived with it, and she was really one of the first wives club of CTE, where her and Brenda Spinks, Leon's now widow, and Ken Norton's widow, Rose Norton, they were sort of all on Facebook and going to after-dinner events with their husbands, and they were able to talk about it and share their problems and talk to different neurologists, and she was eye-opening. And then for one chapter in the book, I went and spent a morning with Leon and Brenda Spinks, and Leon's no longer with us, but that was a real eye-opener. I wanted to speak to Leon because he was probably the biggest name high-profile sufferer who had severe CTE, and I wanted to go and see what it was like being with Leon and Brenda just on a normal day, and that was very eye-opening as well. So I think the people behind the scenes, the family members, have really allowed me to see a window which I wasn't really expecting to be able to peek through when I started writing the book.
What do you hope happens? What do you hope is the result of this book, Damage? What do you hope happens?
Well, yeah, I think there's two things there. I think the firstly is, you know, if it helps one fighter or one fighter's family understand what's going on when previously there was no information available to them, then I think it's done its job. In terms of the wider scheme of things, you know, I would like it to force change from commissions and from the British Boxing Board of Control and the high-ranking commissions through the USA, where people are made to read it. You know, the athletic commissioners, fighters, trainers, managers, and particularly the trainers and managers, the guys that are supposed to be looking out for the fighters, but so often try to squeeze an extra payday out of them. I just hope that it, and also I mentioned at the start about the narrative, I hope that it somehow flips the narrative on this sort of sorry, and I know it's how we started with the fighter who lost everything, but the fighter who sort of has lost everything, who's now really struggling, who might be slurring his words or staggering in his steps and be very depressed, and who's made a slew of bad business decisions and lost his money, which we now know could be all linked to brain damage and brain injuries. And I'd love for that narrative to change, the fact that these guys are warriors and they deserve respect into old age. And then I suppose the other level, sorry if I'm going on, but
it's quite all right, don't worry about that.
I would love it to be part of, you know, the conversation in commentaries for fights. You know, when fights are getting really tough and really grueling, it's fair for the commentators to say, this is the sort of fight that, you know, might spell trouble for these guys years down the line because they're taking an awful lot of punishment. It happens. That's part of the sport. And that's what that needs to be part of the narrative and part of the conversation. It's going to be hard to say and it's going to be hard to introduce, but it's important that we're all aware of what these guys are actually putting on the line.
I mean, that would be one for the referees, though, wouldn't it? Presumably, if you are taking, I mean, we've always seen, there's always been those horrible fights that go on too long. They would argue that's the referee's job to step in.
Oh, yeah, no, but what I'm talking about with the commentators is their opportunity to educate the viewers.
Yeah.
And to say, you know, to talk to, you know, the thousands and the millions tuning in and say, you know, this is what is happening with boxing, and this is what does happen, and it's perfectly fair comment. In terms of referees, yeah, of course, it goes without saying that they should have a real understanding about CTE and the damage caused by repetitive blows to the head, of course.
The book is called Damage, The Untold Story of Brain Trauma in Boxing. It's by Tris Dixon. Tris, I know you're active on social media. Where can people find you?
I'm on Twitter and Instagram, just at Tris Dixon.
And can't let you go without a quick aside, because over the weekend there was a rather important announcement on the Instagram with Mr. Fury and Mr. Joshua. What do you think?
People will criticise me for pouring cold water on it. It's one of those that until they're in there hitting each other, I won't believe it. But yeah, I see that people made Tyson Fury an early betting favorite, and I can understand that. I hope it happens. It would have been great for it to have been in the UK, but money talks, and it looks like it's off to Saudi Arabia. That's the nature of the business, unfortunately. Every time boxing seems to be able to help itself, it will shoot itself in the foot.
Well, we'll see how that one pans out. But in the meantime, congratulations on a much-needed book. The book is called Damage, The Untold Story of Brain Trauma in Boxing. It's by Tris Dixon. Tris, it's been a pleasure to speak to you today.
Thanks for having me. Thank you.